Welcome back to another episode of the Exterminatus Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things competitive in the world of Warhammer 40,000. My name's Eric. With me is my co-host, Ray.
Hello.
And we're coming to you here on Prime Day. That's right. Get all your online shopping from the world's largest retailer. But I'd like to take a minute to remind you the true meaning of this day, when Optimus Prime gave his life to save the world. Let's not lose that in all the hoopla of online shopping, bargains, and steals. Thank you for that moment of silence. So this week, all about the ATC. Later in the show, we will have Team Spike Club, who finished sixth out of the 85 teams on. They'll talk about their experience, both the 6 months leading up to the tournament, planning the travels experiences, as well as the actual game experiences they had themselves. But for that, we had some news, Ray. We got a new Space Marine chapter showing up in White Dwarf.
Yeah, so anybody who pays attention knows that about, 2.5 or so weeks ago, it's been about a month now, the last White Dwarf came out, and on the very back, it hinted, pretty much said, that the July issue would be about the Blood Ravens. It wasn't for sure if we'd be seeing chapter approved rules for them like we saw in January for the Crimson Fists. But at least recently, as of today, I saw a YouTube video where a gentleman decided to go over a leak. I don't know if it was actually his copy or not, but somebody's already got their copy of the White Dwarf, and they've posted a few pictures of, sure enough, rules for playing Blood Ravens in 8th edition.
So let's go over the first one. Is their main character, who is Gabriel Angelos, who's not to be confused with Gabrielle Angelos, who was the 2009 Chaparral Middle School Spelling Bee champion. But let's go over Gabriel's stats here. So he's basically a Space Marine Captain and Terminator armor with Chapter Master role. So kind of nifty. He's got the Iron Halo for 4-up invul. He's got the Chapter Master role, so you can reroll all-to-hit rolls. Interesting all-to-hit rolls, not just misses. He's got a nifty ability called Leap Into the Fray, which basically he mosh pits into somebody on the charge phase. On a 4+, a enemy unit suffers D3 mortal wounds if he charged into him. You know, I hate that mechanic. I keep saying it every week. D6 on a 4+ D3. Why don't you just make it D6 minus 3 mortal wounds? One die roll, please. But the interesting thing is he comes with a relic weapon. I believe it's unique to him only, called the God Splitter, which is just an awesome name to begin with. So at first you're like, it's just a Thunder Hammer. What are you so excited about? And it does have that mode called the Mighty Strike mode. Strength times 2, minus 3 AP, flat 3 damage, minus 1 to hit. And every wound roll of six, inflicts an additional mortal wound. But it also has a second option called Sweeping Blows. Okay, so at this point, you'll be strength plus 2, AP minus 1, 1 damage, but you get an additional 3 attacks and none of the minus 1 to hit modifier. So if you're attacking hordes, you're strength 6. If you're attacking big stuff, you're strength 8. With 5 attacks, by the way, base, so 8 attacks against hordes. I could definitely see this guy being quite useful. And interesting, looking at his keywords, Deptus Astartes, Blood Raven, so keeping close to that. And this guy clocks in at a cool 185 points. So, and he has the Rites of War Warlord trait, which I'm assuming is unique. I have to look that up. I'm not sure if that is from the Space Marine one.
Or give me one second, I can actually find that out for you.
Yeah, Rites of War. So while Ray's looking that up, the Blood Ravens, their chapter tactic is very interesting. It's a mechanic we've sort of seen before, but it's taken to a new level. When resolving an attack against a made against a unit with this tactic, an unmodified wound roll of 1 or 2 always fails, irrespective of any abilities that weapon or model making that attack may have. In addition, when a psychic test or deny the witch test is taken for a psychic bottle with this tactic, reroll all or any dice rolls of one. So on a 2d6, rolling ones, not a big deal, but any chance you get a reroll for free when it comes to psychic phase, that's pretty cool. But the wound thing is very interesting. So any unmodified ones and twos always fail. So when you think about that, ones always automatically fail anyway. So a big whoop. But it's the two that makes it interesting. So if you're already toughness four, being a standard Marine, so strength eight and higher still wounds you on threes. So pretty interesting. Nice. It's not quite. Yeah, not quite a minus one, but some of the Knigets and some of the larger weapons that we see in the game make you a little more impervious to that. So I'd be curious if that also extends to vehicles as well. According to this, any model. So I think that makes it very interesting.
Yeah. So real quick, what was the Warlord trait?
Sorry, it is a Rites of War.
Yeah, Rites of War is from the main... Codex for Space Marines. That's the one that is friendly chapter units within 6 inches of your warlord automatically pass morale tests.
That's not bad. I'll take it. So you got a fearless bubble, you got reroll hits, and I got a thunder hammer, and I can blow bubblegum and walk at the same time. That's pretty cool. All right. We got a couple of relics that were shown off. Actually, one relic to start off with. It is a bolt pistol, and its replacement is a range. It's called the Purgatorius. We might have to steal that as our side podcast name. Range 12 inches, pistol 2, strength 5, EP minus 3, 2 damage. So it's not bad. If you have to take a pistol, that's not a bad pistol to take. I don't know if I would spend a command point to get an extra one, but.
Oh, so one thing I like about this is it says it replaces a bolt pistol or a heavy bolt pistol. So it can go on either a Primaris Space Marine, like Captain or Lieutenant, or just, you know, your old fashioned one. You know, the non-primaris.
Interesting. Not pick up on that. Gives you a little flexibility between the old and the new Marines. Very nice. They also showed off one of the new stratagems. It's one command point called Chief Librarian. Use the stratagem before the battle. Select one Blood Raven's Librarian model in your army. That model gains the Chief Librarian keyword and the following ability, Chief Librarian. This model knows one additional psychic power from their chosen discipline and can attempt to deny one additional psychic power in your opponent's psychic phase. You may only use this strategy once per battle.
So this one isn't, you know, crazy useful, but you know, if you're running, you know, only one librarian, which, I mean, some people who like to play on the more narrative side might want. You know, having plus one's not bad. I want to say your average librarian only runs with two psychic powers.
I will look that up for you. Give me one sec.
Kind of working on that right now. I just got to find the page. the Space Marine Codex is the thickest one. That's why it's $10 more than the rest. Here we go. So it looks like the... librarians, yeah, two psychic powers and deny one. So being able to cast three and deny two is that can make a pretty big difference with Space Marines. It's not like Thousand Suns where you've got someone who can and cast
remember, and it's deny okay, three. You upgrade one, but it doesn't mean that's your only librarian in your list. And they all benefit from that rerolling ones from deny and casting. So I'm not saying they're the next Thousand Suns, but they're better than your average Joe when it comes to psychic powers.
Now, what I'm saying is, if you're only running one or two, having one more for each casting and denying makes a big difference. If you're running, I don't know, five librarians, it still makes a difference, but nowhere near as much of a difference.
I don't know if I would run five, but I'm thinking, okay, usually I'm taking Null Zone and then probably, it's not Gate of Infinity, but it's something close to it. I think it's Veil of Time is what I'm thinking of. Start your next turn, reroll, yeah, reroll charges. So, that, you know, sometimes you need to be in two places at once. And if the guy's out of position, you have a second one lying around to do that. That's not bad. So, not saying it's overly broken, but I don't need overly broken. I need tools. So, that works out fine. I just like anytime I can get reliability on a psychic power, especially something as vital as Null Zone, I'm in. So that was the big news in terms of the new Marines coming out. A lot of the other new releases coming out this particular week are for other products. So that Games Workshop is promoting. Apparently Warcry is making this big splash, so which looks to be a kill team for Age of Sigmar, but it's weird because it's all new factions. I'm very confused. But a lot of interesting models. So for those of you looking for some conversion bait, take a look at them. They're there for the taking.
Yeah, so kind of funny enough, I saw the whole thing where they described it as kill team for Sigmar, but really I think it's more like Necromunda for Age of Sigmar, because their main focus is going to be on a bunch of these little Chaos Warbands, which, yeah, they're going to eventually find their way into the main game just because that's what they've been doing with the AOS stuff. You know, you can see that with Shadespire, which is also kind of like a Necromunda for AOS. But what they're also going to be doing is adding in some of the main game factions and making it where you'll be able to play them in Warcry.
One other quick follow-up. We talked earlier about Apocalypse. We think we talked about that two episodes ago. And one of the things that has eluded us is what is competitive point levels or power levels that they're going to be using. There wasn't anything specific for match play, but what they describe is a game of Apocalypse should be a power level of 300 or higher. So when you figure the average 40K army is around 120 to 140 power level, it's basically a 4,000 or 5,000 point army that you're looking at. So keep that in mind if you're ever looking at the competitive circuit or running an event near you. But it was interesting. A lot of teams, a lot of organizers, just to get demo games in, are actually playing smaller games of APOC just to get players into the game and fewer detachments and the like just to get the hang of it. But that would be your news for the week. So, as you mentioned, lots of ATC coverage, but there were two other tournaments this past weekend, and we're going to get into their top players right after this break.
Are you a gamer that has more bare plastic than you have time to paint? Do paintbrushes spontaneously combust when you hold them? If either of these is true, contact White Crow Studios and get your models painted by a college-trained professional painter. You can contact Bo at whitecrow.commissions@gmail.com and view his previously painted models at White Crow Studios on Facebook.
Welcome back after the break. Our first event of the day brings us to Ontario, Canada for the Hogtowner 2019. Didn't realize there was that many swine in the Toronto area. I always thought it was a more metropolitan area. But the Hogtowner featured two rounds, well over, good grief, almost 40 players. And your top five, Ray, what does it look like?
So in fifth place, we had, not for sure if it's Jan or Jan, Jones with High Fleet Kronos. And fourth was Adam Traw with Imperial Knights. And third, Luis Gomez with Cadian Shock Troops. Second was Lucas Duchesne with Raven Guard. That's kind of cool. And in first place is Brent Moore with Orcs.
So Brent's list is very typical to another Orc list we're going to talk about later in the show, but I am curious what a Raven Guard army looks like that went second place. So it starts with a battalion. And in that list, he goes with Raven Guard. Surprise, surprise. So he's got Gabriel Angelos. Again, not the Spelling Bee champion, but the new chapter master. And that is indeed his warlord. He's also got a Primaris Librarian. Intercessor squads of 1, 2, 3, 4 of them, I believe. There's an odd page break here. Bear with me. And Primaris Ancient. And then he also has a Relic Sicarian Venator Tank Destroyer. That's got that big turbo laser. It's a pretty much an anti-tank variant. And on the fast attack slide, he's got Inceptors. Wow. Looks like the bare minimum 3-man unit. And then for his second detachment, he's got 2 Primaris Lieutenants. Those models are really hard to come by. I wish they came out with more of those. 2 units of 5 Hellblasters and a Relic Leviathan Dreadnought, followed by a Thunderfire Cannon. And, of course, the Obligatory Tech Marine, 2 fire, says Thunderhand Cannon. So there you go. A very compact list. Let's do, many of you guys have messaged us online. You want more in-depth coverage. So right off the bat, I'm seeing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So he's definitely got 6 characters. Easy bait for Headhunter. He's got, looks like, 5... Should have done this ahead of time. 6, 7. Looks like about 12 drops for deployment purposes. Pretty small footprint, though, because it's got all his objective secured squads are 5-man squads, but they are all Primaris Marines, so they're all 10 wounds. So a fair amount of durability there as well. The Sicarian tank, I believe, is toughness 7, 12 wounds, I think it is. I have to double check that. And, but it, where it makes up here is the Hellblaster squads and that the Leviathan Dreadnought. Interesting, he took the double flamer with Storm Cannon array. So he's got quite a bit of distance shooting as well as protection from would-be assaulters with a Thunderfire Cannon. I wonder if he's using that more for, rather than killing, but the harassment. There's all the varying shells where he can reduce movement and whatnot. But the indirect fire is the key thing that makes that thing work.
If nothing else, it's a good distraction.
It's really annoyance because basically if you're reducing your movement by half, at first if you're targeting the right unit, 6-inch move becomes a 3-inch move. It's almost like you lose a turn and becomes pretty powerful there. So I'm not sure which mission format they're using at this tournament because I'm noticing the scores 15, 13. Looks like you're using a 20-nil system of some kind.
Possibly. It's definitely unique. It's not...
So, very interesting setup. And so congratulations to all our winners from the Hogtowner 2019. We now go south of the border from Canada to Houston, Texas for Warzone Houston. And Greg, what's our top 5 look like there?
All right. In 5th place, we've got Mark Lee with their Sirianni. And 4th is Vincent Arroyo with Chaos Soup.
Friend of the show!
3rd place, Clifton Murica Russell with Gene Stealer Cult. 2nd place is Colin McDade with Adeptus Astartes. And in 1st is Nick Sutherland with Orcs.
So very cool. A lot of big names. Also, if you look down the list there, William Ivey in 8th, Michael DeHaos in 9th. By the way, interesting, Michael has switched from Inari to Imperium since the FAQ has been dropped. And also Nick Gower in 15th place. So a couple other big names that are still at the event. So looking at our top 2 lists, our first place winner is Nick Sutherland. He's playing Orcs. And his list, very much like the previous list we were talking about, it starts with Evil Sons Battalion with the Big Mech and War Boss. He's got 3 large units of boys, all of them 30-man squads with Sluggas and Choppas. And then the second battalion is a Death Skulls attachment. And he does take the specialist Dreadwaw, so he's got a big mech with the souped up shock attack gun and two other big mechs, and then 3 units of 10 Gretchen and 2 units of 6 mech guns, all of them smasher guns. And then finally he rounds out a third battalion, this being Bad Boons, 2 Weird Boys, 3 units of Gretchen, 2 of the 10 man, 1 of them 13 man, and a unit of 15 Ludas. So obviously with that many battalions, he's rocking a ton of CP at 17 command points. He's probably not going to go first anytime soon because he's got 19 drops. But again, half the missions in ITC, it's all based off a die roll. By the way, I played a mission practice. I hate that damn roll. Oh, I hate that. Oh, I rolled first. Okay, you have to deploy your whole army and you get to go first. Okay, great. Yay. So yeah, 19 drops. He's not getting that +1 to initiative anytime soon. Interesting, if you're picking secondaries against him, he gives up 5 units from Mark to Death. Those big blobs are easily over a power level 7, so as well as the mech guns. So 5 units out of 4 to get Mark for Death. He's got 187 models, so we would recommend Reaper. And he's also got 7 characters for Headhunter. So lots of opportunity to get some points, but he's got a ton of board control with this list, and a lot of wounds to get through with all those Gretchen screens, and he's got plenty of command points to pretty much, if there's a Gretchen on the board, it's going to screen something. Our second place list was Colin McDade with Adeptus Astartes, and his list is probably very different, as you may have expected, but looking at there with us, he starts off with an Imperium Death Watch battalion, librarian with a watch captain, and he's got 1, 2, 3 veteran squads. They're pretty much identical. He's got the biker, a terminator, two terminators, a vanguard veteran, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 veterans, all with storm shields, except for the last one was a Death Watch frag cannon, and of course the watch sergeant with a storm shield as well. So hard to shift. He's got all the tricks of the trade there. So in terms of get multiple storm shields, giving him the 4-up invul save, the frag cannon, it's got the option to be a flamer versus a las cannon, and correct me if I'm wrong, I gotta double check this, but a terminator allows you to fall back and shoot, or is that the biker? One of them.
I thought it was the biker that allowed that.
Okay. And remember, the Terminator gives you a nifty ability as well. They all. So to the nifty tablet of 1,000 codices. Storm shield. I take out, by the way, storm shield is a 3+ invul. I said that wrong earlier, so I want to correct myself before the internet jumps all over my back here. So relentless assault when he includes any bikers, they may fall back and charge. So Ray was right on that. And what does the Terminator give? I could have swore it was... Oh my God, where'd it go? I can't find it.
Someone's yelling.
Oh, there it is. For purposes of the Terminator, they do not have combat shield, storm shield. Oh, there it is. Unflinching, a unit automatically passes morale tests if it contains a Terminator. Yeah, I could hear the entire internet screaming at me that answer. Thank you, appreciate it. So every one of these units is fearless, at least five models with a 3-up invul, and the other one having a 2-up, 5-up. And then, of course, you have the random biker in the unit as well. So he's got 3 of those, so... as opposed to 30 orc boys and a whole bunch of Gretchen, very focused unit, but almost equally as durable. His second battalion is a Blood Angels battalion. 2 captains, yes, you guessed it, Thunderhammer and Storm Shield on with jump packs, 2 infiltrator squads and a Scott Squad. And then he finally rounds out his army with a 3rd attachment, which is a spearhead of Raven Guard, 2 librarians in Phobos armor, and three-man eliminator squads is what I was trying to say. So a very focused list, a very different. He does have the 6 characters, so he is giving up 6 points on Headhunter. 12 command points, which is pretty impressive for Space Marines. Still has 15 drops, but everything else much harder. Only 3 models marked for death and significantly fewer models. So picking your secondaries against this list, you may have to go towards the your usual recons and behind enemy lines and whatever works for your army, because he's not giving up a lot of points there. So that is our coverage of Warzone Houston 2019. After the break, we will talk to Team Smite Club with their recent return from the ATC. Stay tuned for that. Lots of great insight for that. We'll be here after the break. Hey there, Eric from the Exterminatus podcast, and I'm talking to all you tournament organizers out there. Do you have an event coming up? Now, naturally, we talk about all those GT and major level events coming up throughout week to week, but we usually do it after the fact. If you want to talk about your event ahead of time to get some more people to come to your event, this is your opportunity. We are opening up our ad space for some lucky TOs to, you know, let us know about your event. Give us a minute to talk about what makes your event special and glow about your event, so drive some like-minded competitive 40K players to your particular area. Hit us up on our Facebook page for more details, and we'd love to support your local community. So here our way of giving back to tournament organizers throughout the world. Only your friends here at the Exterminatus Podcast. All right, welcome back. And as I promised, we have special guests for this week's show. Coming off their sixth place performance at the 2019 ATC, I have 4 members of Team Smite Club, Aaron, Daniel, Mark, and Team Captain Matt. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here to have you guys on. So a lot of our listeners are not familiar with the ATC format. What's the best way to describe it?
So the ATC format is a team tournament. Each team is made up of 5 guys. What's a little bit different than other team tournaments is each of your guys plays your game individually. So it's not like 2 guys on the same table. So it will be your team of 5 versus another team of 5. And before everyone starts playing games, there's a round of pairing. It's kind of like a mini game before you start the real games, where you go and decide which one of your five guys is playing which of their 5 guys. And once everybody's matched up, you play the rounds, you aggregate the scores across the 5 games, and you determine which team won.
So obviously, this isn't something where you just show up for the weekend and think, hey, this is what we're going to do. So tell me a little bit about the planning. How far in advance were you guys thinking of who's going to play what faction, what lists?
I would say probably we started talking about going maybe 6 months ago. Somebody can correct me if it was different. there's a little bit of commitment in the sense that everybody kind of, you got to find people who are willing to go, and that takes a lot of planning ahead of time. As far as deciding factions, it's a little bit kind of last minute, I think, for some. Like for my faction, I started a new army for the tournament, and I think we only made that final decision maybe like 6 weeks ago, five weeks ago. And my experience with other teams is that's fairly typical. A lot of teams kind of chase the meta, and a lot of people jump into new armies just specifically for this tournament, and a lot of those decisions get made pretty close to the tournament date.
What were some of the things that were kind of hemming and hawing last minute?
Well, anybody else can jump in. So like my list, like I said, I started playing Tau specifically for the tournament. And so exactly what that list was going to look like, I was still kind of tweaking it like a couple of days before lists were due for me. I don't know about other people, probably had similar experiences would be my guess.
Yeah. Let's probably go around the team and see which everyone was playing. So, Aaron, what were you playing?
I was playing my Imperial Knights and Catagen list. So 3 Crass Crusaders, 2 Thermal Lances, 1 Rapid Fire Battle Cannon, Missile Pods, 2 Battalions of Catachans with Strachan, Company Commanders, 6 Squads of Infantry, 3 Mortar Teams, Priest, and then the last minute changes were I had some extra points left over, so I put a few mortars into the Catachan squads. Like, coming up to the event after the big FAQ, I was kind of meh on knights, and I was trying to make other things work, so I was trying to, like, come up with ideas. I really wanted to, like, run the Ryza Plasma Cataphron trick, but the list didn't work out. Sorry, Mark, that messed up a lot of our army ideas for a while and kind of took factions away from Mark, so I apologize to Mark, but we eventually got everything sorted out. All worked out, I think.
So correct me if I'm wrong, you cannot repeat a faction within the team, correct?
You cannot, which was part of the issue we were having.
Got it. So Mark, what did you end up settling on for a list?
Yeah, so we went back and forth a few times, really. Originally, we were in a debate about whether I should play Gene Stealer Cult or Matt should play Gene Stealer Cult. And then we ended up with Matt going with Gene Stealer Cult at first. And then we were settling on whether or not I would try to find some other Imperium army or if I would pick up Tau and play Tau for the tournament. What ended up happening, though, is with the Jeff Robinson list from BAO, I felt really comfortable with that list and those tanks and everything like that. So I went out and grabbed those. So we would use the Custodes instead of having that Gene Stealer Cult fix into our list. So then Matt picked up Tau because we thought that was a better all around thing, because all we needed to do for the Tau was protect it against flyers. And then they would have a pretty good matchup with almost anything else. So I ended up running with the Custodes along with Blood Angels and AdMech. So I had a Blood Angels battalion with three scout squads, three Rapier quad heavy bolter cannons, and a Librarian Dreadnought and Smash Captain. And then I had the Grya Rusty 17. And then I had a Custodes detachment with two Caladiuses, one Telamon, the Vex Le Praetor for the minus one to hit, and Trajan to give them reroll ones to hit and to wound. And then I also had the room for an assassin to spend the two command points for an assassin, and that was my final list that I took.
Very nice. Now, Daniel, what did you end up bringing? Because you're mostly known as an Inari player, and this was obviously the FAQ dropped right in the middle of your six-month preparation here.
Yeah, so I think I was the only person at ATC that had Inari in the list. I think early on we decided I was going to get whatever Eldar I wanted, so I did kind of suck up a bunch of books running Dark Eldar, Craft Worlds, and Inari. I kind of proof of concepted my list at Gentleman's GT where I finished second. The list changed a little bit. It had to get fine-tuned, and there was some more efficiency I could put into it for ATC. If you want a quick breakdown, it's essentially Craft Worlds Battalion, Farseer Warlock on bikes, Ranger, Storm Guardian, a couple of Wave Serpents, and then a minimum sort of Cabal the Blackheart detachment where I replace one of the Archons with Yvraine to get her back on the table because I love her model, and then a Inari Supreme Command. So it was very weird. I wouldn't recommend anybody try to run that list. It's really fun, but it's really hard, and it punishes you for just the minorest of mistakes.
I understand. Now, one teammate who couldn't make it to the show tonight was Don Husen. What was he playing?
Don had his BAO list, his like 12 model Chaos Space Marines. So it's three Helldrakes, three Derridaeos, three Lord Discordants, and three Contemptor Dreadnoughts. And I believe most, if not all, of the armies, the Purge, so they can shoot into close combat if you were to happen to tie up one of their buddies. So it was a list that Don wasn't super hot on anymore. There have been some changes in the meta since BAO, and I don't think he wants to run that as like a GT singles list anymore. But he had a ton of experience with it. We kind of felt like it still had a lot of value on the team. There were some matchups that it just destroyed pretty strongly. And so, you know, a combination of its matchups and Don's familiarity with it, he just brought it.
Sounds
again.
Great. So Mark alluded to it a little bit when he was talking about list selection there. Thinking ahead, when you guys are designing your list, are you just trying to find the best list for you, or are you thinking ahead to we want every matchup?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. So I'm not sure that we actually did this optimally this year. What a lot of teams do is a lot of teams will design a particular list that during the matchup game is just not going to give up very many points. So it doesn't necessarily win games, but it loses by very, very small amounts. And so that generally gets referred to as a defender. And so when you have to nominate your first list to go out there, as what they call a defender, and other people will send attacker lists at it. You know, the point is to just, you'll probably lose, but you'll only lose by 1 or 2 points. And then the rest of the lists on the team often are designed to table their opponents. They skew a little bit. They're not really well-rounded lists. And again, win big, because in order to win the round as a team, your margins of victory on most of your tables actually have to be pretty big. We kind of went in with more of a, every one of us had what I felt was a fairly well-rounded list. We didn't skew very hard on any of them. We didn't have a super clear defender. And the reason we did that is the way, when you aggregate all the scores from the games each round. So let's say Don won his game by 20 points. Okay. Our team would go up by 20. And then I lost my game by 10. Well, then now our team is up 10. Okay. And you keep aggregating the scores like that across all the games. And at the end of the round, if your team is ahead by 21 points or more, that's a round win for your team. Now, they added a caveat to the system. I think maybe it was new last year, that if you win 4 out of the 5 games, the point differential doesn't matter. So actually, you could, in theory, be on the downside of the point differential, but win 4 out of the 5 matchups by like 1 point, and then you just win the round. And so kind of, you know, I think our thinking was that incentivized teams to skew less and build more well-rounded take-all-comers lists. And I think that's what all of us did. And, you know, it ended up working out all right, but that's, you know, others can comment. At least in my opinion, the other teams didn't seem to follow the same thinking.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I think we had the idea that the 4-1 would be a little more valuable than it was. And I think since we were running a couple of kind of weird lists, we felt a little more all-comery. And unfortunately, Aaron took the brunt of some of eating our bad matchups without having the tools in his list to be like a soak or a soak defender. And he was a champ for that. But I think I can't speak for anybody else, but certainly for me, I didn't understand the format and scoring and sort of the meta strategy of the tournament really until like the end of day two. So for our first time out, I think we had a good plan. It was not the best plan, certainly given that I didn't realize there was going to be so many ties. You know, we would be breaking ties all over the place, and that differential was like the main tiebreaker. So that's where you need.
Yeah. I took on the role of taking some of the questionable matchups, matchups that not necessarily everybody wanted, but I could still score some points on. And if you look at my record, you'll see just by the record that I didn't do so great at the tournament. I think I had like a 2-4 record, but like two of those games, I went in like with the knowledge that I was expected to lose those games, so just keep them close. And then I definitely did not go into the event with that plan in mind, and I definitely did not have the optimal list to do that for point denial. So, like, if there were two of four games that I lost that were, I was able to keep close, like not ideally close, like 2 or 3 points, but I think my close losses were like by 8. But I also just had like 2 losses that were just over 10 points. I think the John Lennon one I lost by like 15 or 20 with something ridiculous that was not helpful to the team. But like, we didn't really plan for me just to take the bad matchups in the beginning, but it happens.
Yeah,
it worked out. And everybody else.
Go ahead, Aaron.
Okay. Everybody else. Go on. But it seemed to me taking the questionable matchups for the team helped the team, helped everybody else get into favorable pairings so they could win their games.
And I think it's important to talk about that. So, just if you're not familiar with the format, sometimes you may look at that and you look at like one individual on the team, you know, actually Aaron, hats off to you for going these 2-4, because sometimes player in that role might actually go like 0-6, you know, and they could still be the team MVP because they're expected to be tabled and they were able to pull out close losses or even ties, which means the other team was counting on, you know, a blowout, and now they got to figure out we're going to get those points from another matchup. Generally, that was the matchup that should have been ideal. It's almost, you know, going back to the rock, paper, scissors mentality. They played rock. We're going to play paper. We should win this. And then all of a sudden, how did we not win that round? And, you know, great job being rock against the paper. And it's, you know, you can choose all the matchups all you want, but you still have to execute on the table. So tell me one more thing, Aaron, on that. How do you keep yourself motivated? Because you want to pull for the team, but you know, you're losing at the same time.
Yeah, it was hard for a stretch there. After my game five, I had just lost two games in a row by large margins, and I felt I was hurting the team. But, you know, I was beating myself up, but everybody was like, hey, hang in there. You're doing a good job, and it really helped. So I appreciate the support of the team on that. Kept me going. And then I went into game six again. Like, we were looking at the pairings that we were probably going to get the night before, and I'm looking at them all, and it's like, none of those are favorable for me. So I just went in again, like, expecting to lose, but knowing I had everybody's support, it was able to keep my hope, my spirits up, and I gave the guy a game for the most part, only lost by a couple and kept it close, but we won all the rest of the four games, so I guess that really didn't matter, but it was rough.
It mattered for placing. It mattered for placing a lot, so.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
The because there are so many ties in the format, I feel like every point matters all the time. Like, for example, so they give out awards for the top five. We were, I think, 4 or 5 points behind the top five, right? And across 5 games every round and 6 rounds, right? So across 30 games, right, picking up an extra point here or there, one extra point around is the difference between like placing and not placing. So when you get somebody, and we threw Aaron under the bus a little bit because again, we are kind of expecting him to do a job that his army wasn't built to do. But, you know, you got to fight for every single point, because if, you know, if I had picked up an extra point here, if Don had picked up an extra point there, you know, maybe we place, you know, at the end of the tournament. And so, keeping those losses as small as possible is a huge, huge part of the tournament.
So let's go on the other side of the coin then. We've talked about the put forward or the defender list. Who in the team would you say would be your prey list, the predator who had to get the big point?
I think most of the time that probably fell to me, Don, and Dan. Oftentimes I feel like, well, so Dan in most situations felt like he had kind of the best all-around slate of matchups. Like he could win by, you know, 10 points against most armies. And so a couple of times we put him up as a defender, but over the course of the pairings, you have to put up two, right? So it would go, you know, something like Dan and Aaron, or Aaron and Dan. And then, you know, Dan, just by the construction of his army, did all right, and then we kind of, Aaron did not get such preferable matchups. But I think across most of the 6 rounds, the way that it fell, most of the points were generated off of Don, Dan, and myself. And again, that's nothing about us three as players. That's all team. That's all just design and pairing. So
this is not exactly located in the greatest, largest metropolitan area. And Facebook was lit up of all my other 40K friends of various ways of getting to Chattanooga. Tell me about your travels. So getting to Tennessee.
I think one of the big guys should talk about this one, because I had it easier than the rest of them.
So I think I'll take the reins on this one. So Wednesday night, I get a text message saying that our flight was canceled. So this text message came in at like 9:30 p.m. and our flight is scheduled to leave at 9 a.m. So, you know, less than 12 hours before our flight is scheduled to leave, they send us a text and say, hey, your flight's canceled. We rebooked you. So now you're not getting in into Georgia until Friday. So for myself, I had purchased my ticket and Don's ticket together, and they rescheduled us to go through LAX. So they were pretty much, we would depart at the same time. We would then go to Los Angeles, and then from Los Angeles, we had like a 6-hour layover, and then flew to Georgia, and we would get there approximately about 11:30 p.m., which is not what we had wanted. Like, our original plan, we would get there at 3, and then we would travel up there, get settled, and, you know, get a good night's rest and get ready for the next day. So I had texted everybody through our group chat and was like, hey, did everyone else get this? Just to make sure that, you know, we're all on the same page. They all got the same message. Luckily for Aaron and Matt, they got rescheduled on the next flight out, which was at 12 o'clock straight into Atlanta. But myself and Dan had to call up and work on with the airlines to get us put onto that flight. And I had a lot more of a runaround than he did. I had to call back 3 times before I finally got someone who would put us on the same flight as the rest of the team. But you know, definitely on the flight side, it was a pain.
Yeah, I'll chime in a little bit too. So I was in the middle of trying to decide whether I was going to stay up all night and then try to sleep on the plane or go to bed. And it was pretty much past my normal bedtime, honestly. Aaron called me. I didn't even see the text. And I thought he was messing with me. I thought Aaron was just being a jerk.
To be expected.
Didn't believe him until I looked at my email. To be expected from Aaron, yeah. But like Mark said, we did get all on the same flight, you know, get in a little later than we had planned. And then we had a hurricane situation when we left Atlanta in the rain and almost died to a couple of big rigs trying to run us over. But, you know, we got there and we got it figured out.
We're glad it was safe travels. And obviously you guys made it back safely. So we've done team tournaments together in the past. ATC, you know, 85 teams, 5 players each. So rough math, that's pretty close to LVO size in terms of number of participants. What was it like walking into that hall the first time?
Humid.
Muggy.
Bugs. Humidity. Bugs. Humidity.
More it bugs. Was really weird being cold and sweaty at the same time.
It was like 80 degrees, and so that's cold for Arizona people, at least for me, being that I work outside a lot. And then, but yet you took a shower. You felt like you were drier in the shower. And then for about 39 seconds after you got out of the shower, you felt like a human being. And then you felt like you were a fish. I felt like I was swimming, not walking. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, more humid than humid.
Ugh, it was disgusting. It was like 90% humidity. It was ridiculous. And the guys are saints for listening to me complain about it, because I complain about it a lot. And I'm not a complainer, and I complained about it a lot.
But in real talk, though, it was exciting. Anytime you go to a big tournament like that where there's a lot on the line, it's exciting. You walk in there and you're ready to go. You know, you got your team ready. We got our jerseys on. We got our armies ready. You know, we just want to get into it. It was a little slow at first because we got there around like 10:30 or so. And then we sat around for about 2 hours waiting, you know, for them to say, okay, now you guys can play your first game. So it got a little frustrating with that because we were ready once we got there. But apart from that, it was exciting. It was a great trip, and I don't think any of us regret it at all.
So with that many players, when we've seen how LVO does officiating, what was the judging like and what was the terrain like?
Sparse.
I thought I was about to get a yellow card on stream for arguing with
the judging was they had quite a few judges. I felt like they did a good job with representation, although when we were on stream, it took my table a long time to get a judge at one point. But the judging was uneven, which I think you can expect from any set of judging, right? At that, like you said, 430 players or 28 or whatever it was. I actually thought the organization side was really good. The judging, I had some judges tell me some things that I don't know where they came up with them, but I've also, I was also wrong about some stuff. So you got to take that in stride. Yes, judge, and move on. You can't take those yellow cards for sure for arguing with a judge.
Yeah, I'll say on the judging, I I've been to the ATC several times. I agree. I like the word inconsistent. I would use that same word to describe it. That said, I will cut them some slack. I've helped out for judging with Adepticon for many years. And so I've kind of been on both sides of that, and finding enough people to work the floor on a tournament that size is really hard. And my understanding is it's in Chattanooga because that club, I believe, is based out of Chattanooga, right? So it's not like a huge metropolitan area where they can draw off of like millions and millions of people, right? So it's a reasonably small club, and it, from my understanding at least, and with the resources that they have, you know, I think that overall, they do a pretty good job.
Well, if you look at the history of the event and the size that it's at, they obviously do a fantastic job. And I think it's just a great lesson for anyone as the tournament circuit as a whole has grown. You know, like you said, you got to pull more and more people to be judging. And one thing that has been, I can tell you this on the back end, you know, there's supposed to be more training for judges coming out from an ITC standpoint. And it's been backlogged a little bit. And so hopefully that'll clean up some of the inconsistencies. But the at least the Facebook page where we can all talk and, hey, this is some rulings that came down. What are your thoughts on it? Helps clean things up a little bit. But there's definitely room for improvement. You mentioned streaming. One particular table, was it like a whole, because there's five of you, so they got to stream for all five tables? How did they set that up?
It was actually really cool how they set that up. So they were doing it through, I think it was Long War was sponsoring it, or they were hosting it or whatever. And so they actually had all five tables camered up, and they had like three cameras on each table. So they had kind of like a side view camera for each side, and then they had a top-down camera for each one. And then they also had a handheld camera if they wanted to get some different angles and such that they could use. And they had a camera that they would move because it's kind of like in a gymnasium where it had like a probably like a 5.5 foot tall like cement barrier right next to us. And so they had another camera on top that kind of gave you a little bit of like an over the shoulder look. And it was actually done pretty well. I went back and watched our game that was on stream, and their production value was amazing. They had the lists uploaded so you could actually see them. They had a really cool application that they had us use. It's not available to the public yet, but they said they had so many people who asked for it that they are going to plan on releasing it. But it was really good for the ITC format as far as scoring. It had an integrated clock feature, so you would just tap on your clock to start your clock, and if you need to switch it over, you tap on your opponent's clock. And then it had integrated for everything, so it had your command points, it had, you know, number of kills you could put on there, it had little boxes you could check mark for if you got kill, if you got hold, killed more, hold more, also had for bonus. And then it had, you know, kept track of all the secondaries as well below. So it was a really cool scoring, pretty much just like your regular score sheet, but it was built into a tablet so they could connect that to the stream, which made it really easy for the people watching keeping up with a score and everything like that, as long as the players were keeping up to date with what was going on. But the production value was great for the stream. They only had the top table on stream, so whatever the top table was at the time, I think, which is why we ended up on their game four. Was the game that we were on there, because we were 1-2 with Wobbly Gentlemen at the time. So we ended up there on table one against them. And the production value was great. Can't say anything bad about that at all. They had everything on point. They had us mic'd up and everything like that. And sound quality was good. And they had a full production studio, it looked like, there. So hats off to them for that.
That app sounds really awesome. That's always one of the areas that struggles is the scoreboard's it's kind of like Fenway Field. You know, somebody's doing hand signals to some guy who's trying to change the scoreboard, and it's always like a good 30-second to a 2-minute delay, you know, to get up to speed. So the fact that it's integrated by the players, I could see that having actually a scoreboard at each table, that could be really awesome. So I look forward to seeing that.
And your question earlier about the terrain, it was very hit or miss. Most of the tables were very sparse. The pods. Yeah. So they had pods of five tables, and it's supposed to be like one heavy terrain, two light, and two medium is what they say it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But compared to what we normally play with on the West Coast, it was very, very sparse. And it was, you know, barely any ruins, except for the stream tables. The tables that you saw on stream, all of those were, you know, beautifully decorated, painted, and all matched up. They had like custom terrain pieces made for whatever actual, you know, map that particular one was on. So it actually fit and looked aesthetically pleasing, which was great. The other matches, you know, like in most tournaments, the further down, you know, the tables you get, the worse the terrain gets. You know, a lot of them were just, you know, a little bit of hills. You know, there was like an ice planet, which, you know, the only cover was if you were an infantry model. And even then you could barely hide behind that. So some of them were just completely sparse, and some of them were just like big, you know, big old buildings and stuff like that, that you could park something on top of. They didn't have any magic boxes, was the big thing for their tournament. Yeah. So they said, if it looks like a magic box, it is not. It is a closed hill that provides cover if you are on top of it.
I actually think that was probably the worst part of the terrain. I didn't mind. So what we're used to out here, their heavy table would be a light, medium light table for us. The only complaint I'll say is I thought that was a weird rule because they had a bunch of magic boxes or, you know, enclosed ruins, but then it almost made them worse. Like they should have just made it so you could shoot in and out of them because you had to be on top, which meant the infantry that you'd normally be trying to protect are now even no line of sight blocking at all. They can be seen from the whole table and all they're getting is a cover save, which in this meta means almost nothing. So that was a little bit of a strange ruling. Again, I think we're a little spoiled out here in Phoenix because of the Vegas, California, you know, Phoenix circuit, even into El Paso. The terrain seems to be pretty good, if not beautiful, functional at least. And the light tables were really light, but they were awkward too. I think it was maybe throwback terrain. You had a lot of these weird like rock pillar things that didn't actually do anything on the table, and then it was like an argument about whether things could stand on top of them or not, but they were 15 inches high. Some of that was really strange, and I've never been there and never experienced terrain like that, so that was a little tough for me to get my head around initially. It didn't affect my play style much, but it was definitely odd.
So throwback terrain, I think, is the exact correct word. I think the first time I went to the ATC, it was back in, I think it was 5th edition. Maybe it had just turned to 6th, but I think a lot of that terrain is still there. And, you know, they've had explosive growth, which is great for them. But I don't think the terrain has caught up to the addition or the size of the event. So it just kind of is what it is.
Matt, you said you used to officiate for Adepticon. It sounds like the same issue Adepticon had over the past few years, where there's still 8th edition rules, 5th edition terrain.
Yeah, it is a little bit, actually. So I missed Adepticon this year for the first time in like 10 years, and it broke my heart. But I heard that they had fixed it, and I know that if any of you listening know Hank Edley, he's a great guy. He actually bought like a big industrial-sized laser-cutting machine and produced in his garage almost all new terrain for all the tables this year. And, you know, it seems like the ATC, like you say, is in a similar situation. I don't know, again, being 400 people is a big tournament, but there's really not much else going on at the ATC other than the 40K tournament. Whereas like the Adepticon team tournament's like 500 guys, but then there's also like 3,000-4,000 more people at the convention all around you, right? So Adepticon had the resources and the ability to invest in some equipment and revamp the terrain, from what I hear, really drastically in like just a year. I don't know that the ATC is in that position. So I don't know. You know, I'm sure we're not the only ones who are talking about it. I'm sure they know that the terrain's really light too. I don't know what options they have for correcting it in the future.
Yeah, it's a tough place to be. I don't want to dwell on negatives about terrain because I self-proclaimed terrain snob, but I'm always the first one to criticize my own terrain the most. But it is a project, and my wife will tell you storing the terrain is a major investment.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's great for that one weekend. What do you do for the other 363 days of the year with that terrain?
Yeah, and I didn't want it to come off as a criticism because I think they did the best job they could do. It was a little bit of a shock because we're terrain spoiled, and then it was a little bit of an odd way to placate maybe with the magic boxes, because when we were told no magic boxes, I just assumed there'd be no square buildings. So it was like a little bit of sticker shock almost for me in that regard. But I think, like I said, I think they did a great job running the event. So. And growth, and like you said, all those other things, I certainly understand.
Well, I'll be sensitive to your time, gentlemen. So let's go once around the block here. Biggest takeaway from the event. We'll start with Aaron.
It was just a crazy event. The room was stacked. Their competition was really strong, and I'm really proud of the team for how we did, how we hung together, even after a disappointing round 5 where we were all just upset, frustrated about what happened. Then we return round six and then go 4-1, and then finish in sixth place. Really proud of the team.
Mark?
I had an absolute blast. You know, for me personally, with having a sports background, the team aspect makes it a lot more fun. You're not just rooting for yourself. You know, you're rooting for your team, and then everything, you know, you want it to go right, and you want everything to be good. And it's a lot more strategy that went into it. I think we underestimated how much strategy that we would require. Luckily, our smarts and our history with the game allowed us to get through most of those matchups. But I think our goal next year will definitely be to get higher than where we ended up this year. And I think we have a good chance of doing that with our group of players that we have here for Smite Club, and with our ability to plan things and think things through thoroughly. I think we'll do pretty well.
Dan?
So I think the thing that stood out most for me was I haven't never really done a team tournament before. And the one I did was sort of, I was sort of a ringer or whatever, you know, filling in on team to fill a team up. I also didn't understand the format. It took me until really round five to get to figure it out. I think the team, I can't say enough about the guys. Everybody on the team performed. Everybody on the team actually, I think, overperformed. With the exception of me, I think I underperformed a little bit, but thank God that didn't hurt the team, because it took me a little while to figure out that you need to push your opponent's scores down as much as you need to score. And Matt told me that 10 times and I just didn't get it. The event was amazing. I've not experienced anything like that in 40K. You know, I've only done LVO once. I haven't been in the competitive scene as long as a lot of these guys. But I actually thought it was more fun than LVO. I actually thought the event itself had a unique sort of like Mark said, a unique, almost sports team feel to it. And I know that sounds corny, because obviously it's not athletic, but I thought, because our round four matchup, I felt like I let the team down. And then when we took the loss in round five, I was already sort of over that, and I was able to hopefully help the other guys get through that. And I think our shakeup Saturday night put us in a good spot Sunday morning, and for us to perform as well as we did Sunday morning. So overall, my impression is that was a crazy new take on Warhammer 40K. And I had a blast, and I loved playing with the guys on our team, and all the support, honestly, that we got from guys who didn't even travel. We had guys from Smite Club help us out quite a bit ahead of time with practice and pairings and lists and everything else. So it was a good experience.
And the captain, Matt.
Yeah. So I guess my big takeaway from the weekend was I think I'm pretty lucky to have moved and be a part of the club that I am. I'm one of the newer guys here. Like most people in Phoenix, I'm a transplant. And so, you know, I didn't know how like exactly things were going to shake on like a, you know, personal level. Like I've never traveled with Don or Mark before. And you know, we live like an hour apart, so we don't even really hang out all that much. And I would just say that from top to bottom, I think we as a team clicked and worked, and I'm really grateful and happy to be a part of this group of guys. So,
well, I appreciate you guys being part of the show tonight and taking time out and talking about your experience. So thanks again for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, guys, hang on. After the break, we'll go over your ITC top 10 as well as upcoming ITC events for next weekend. Come back right after the break. Okay, welcome back after the break. Your ITC top 10 here on Prime Day looks something like this. Now, this does not include the ATC results from this past weekend, but there were some straggling results from the previous weekend from 2 weeks ago that have finally matriculated their way into the overall standings. So it looks something like this. In 10th place, the other guy from Canada, Devin Swan, occupies the 10th spot at 966 points. Nice guy, Orc Boss Richard Kilton comes in 9th place with 978 points. 8th place, John Lennon at 989 points. 7th place, Nick Natavati. 6th place, Jeff Robinson from Team Zero Comp. And 5th place, Manny Chima. 4th place from the Great Britain, Chris Blackman. Third place, Richard Siegler. Second place, TJ Lanigan, but the Canadian Conqueror still holds on to his top spot with a commanding 1,141 points. Jim Vessel holding on to the top spot. Ray, what events do we have coming up next weekend?
All right. Next weekend, we've got the Midnight Sun GT in Palmer, Alaska.
That's a really cool name.
Well, let's see. July. I don't know how long it is, but I know that there's a good while where parts of Alaska experience multiple days where even at midnight, there is still a little bit of a sun above the horizon. I don't know if I thought it was in June, not July, but that probably has something to do with the name.
Probably. I'd be curious if they play all night. That'd be awesome. It's a 5-round event, but it's only on Saturday.
Well,
players are just.
If you're not from around there, you're there. It's you see at 11 p.m. the sun's still up. That'll really throw you off. But all right, moving on. The next tournament listed is TGX GT. The Tabletop Gaming Expo 40K Champs in Mississauga, Ontario. Let's see. There is...
Our friend Archon Scari is a big participant as well as organizer behind that event. So definitely if you're in the Toronto area, please support that event.
There's the Slaughterhouse GT 2019. In East Grand Forks, Minnesota, I believe that is.
It is. Man, that snuck up on me. That's a great event. I'm sorry, Ray, I didn't get you a card this year.
I know Don's going to that one. At least he was talking about
it. Is he really?
I thought I remember seeing something about him going, but I don't
He's
going
to be in like temperature shock because today it was 114 degrees here in Phoenix, and in Minnesota, it's probably, what, like 60 degrees there? I don't know.
Probably 70s or 80s, but... Yeah. Anyway, the next one listed is the Central Valley Showdown GT in Hanford, California. There's the Battle in the Warp First Crusade in Midlothian, Virginia. Never heard of that town before.
What's it called?
The way it's listed on Best Coast Bearings is Midlothian. It's at a place called Battlegrounds. The event is Battle in the Warp, First Crusade.
Yeah. I thought I knew every game store in the Maryland area. Baltimore area. I was wrong.
Virginia.
Oh, that's probably why.
Anyway, next up is the Show Me Showdown GT in Kansas City, Missouri.
It's another great event there. So awesome to see that.
There's the Summer Hull GT in Hull, England. And the last tournament of GT or higher level listed is WinterCon 2019 40K ITC tournament in Mitchell ACT. I can't quite recall off the top of my head where that is, but that is in Australia.
We're going to learn the world geography as well as the latest meta here on the Exterminatus podcast. So.
No kidding. One second. That's the Australian Capital Territory.
You made that up. There's no such thing.
This is what Google tells me. Give me a second, and I will give you a bit of a description of the area for anybody who feels like traveling and wants to go there. Um, So it is in the rough area of the southeast portion. Yeah, okay.
Well, there you go. Two other quick announcements, one tournament-related, one podcast-related. So our big event, as we usually do every spring, is Scorched Earth Open. And we've made a minor change, but we're super excited to this. So first of all, mark your calendars. March 21st and 22nd of 2020. So we're going to aiming to be the first major out of the shoot. It's about 6 weeks after LVO. So if you want to start a new army, you have plenty of time to get them ready. And if you're lazy, you just can bring your LVO army. It's already been painted. So what makes it different here is Scorched Earth. We used to be a standalone tournament. We still will be the Arizona's premier 40K event, but we have teamed up with the Arizona Game Fair. So we are teaming up with Arizona's largest gaming expo, con, whatever you want to call it. So in addition to buying your ticket for the tournament, you also get a full weekend's slate of board games, role-playing, and other miniature games being run throughout the entire weekend. So super excited to be joining up with the Arizona Game Fair. Once again, Scorched Earth Open will be March 21st and 22nd. So we moved the date by a week from what we previously announced, but we're super excited to be teaming up with Arizona Game Fair. Other thing is mentioned how time flies. We are gradually approaching our 100th episode here at the Exterminatus Podcast. And we decided, I told Ray and Ray succumbed to the decision. So for our main topic on our 100th episode, it will be Ask Us Anything. So hit us up on our Facebook page. We'll start up a thread. If you, the listener, have a question that you've always wanted to ask us, post it up there, and we will be answering it in the 100th episode during our main discussion. Looking forward to seeing what you guys have to say. And the snarkier you make the question, the snarkier the answer might be. So be careful what you ask for. So that is our show for this week. Again, thank you again for Smite Club being on earlier. And any additional news or breaking factoids coming up during the week, check us out on our Facebook page at the Exterminatus Podcast Facebook page. In the meantime, my name's Eric.
I'm Raymond.
And thank you for listening to the Exterminatus Podcast. Can't reach the button.